This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Good Widow by Liz Fenton and Lisa Steinke, performed by Dara Rosenberg. She can kill with a smile. She can wound with her eyes. She can ruin your faith with her casual lies. And she only reveals what she wants you to see. She hides like a child, but she's always a woman to me. Billy Joel. Chapter 1. Before. His fingers slithered like a snake to find hers. She opened her palm and accepted them. There was something about the commanding way he reached for her. It felt like a statement. You are mine. The reality was less clear, because she was and she wasn't. And it was in this contradiction where their relationship lived, where it took its deep sighs and shallow breaths, where the highs felt like the top of the most beautiful mountain, breathtaking, exhilarating, peaceful. And the lows felt like the La Brea tar pit she had visited as a child, trapped, anxious, uncertain. She ran her free hand through her hair, sticky from the wind that whipped through the rented Jeep after they'd decided to take the top down to feel the sun, the air, maybe even the spray of the ocean. They were both a bit quiet. It had been a long drive with so many turns, both on the road and in their relationship. So she leaned back and let the silence between them comfort her. She needed to confess something to him. And as long as the wind continued to swirl around them, as long as they kept winding their way slowly down the torturous and twisty backside of the road to Hana, she could hold it on the tip of her tongue, where it had been resting for the last 24 hours. She squeezed his hand to check in, and her heart fluttered when he echoed it and made eye contact for a moment before looking back to the treacherous road. There's something I need to tell you. She had attempted to force the words out several times since she'd found out. As they lay in bed, wound tightly together, their faces shamelessly close, he'd shared his own secrets, their lips brushing as he spoke. But when it had been her turn, the words would not come. She had not been ready for him to know, to face what might happen after. The lush rainforest opened up and presented the ocean, the view so magnificent that she gasped slightly. He squeezed her hand, then pointed down below the cliffs they were navigating, the creases around his eyes deepening as he smiled, his hand leaving hers again, only to downshift as they reached the top of a steep incline. She often wondered why he had chosen her, why he'd risked so much to be with an average-looking woman, the owner of a nose that was a little too small for her face, lips that were just slightly too thin. A girl who worked hard but still hadn't found a career. But in moments like these, this man's love, or lust, or even his affection, she was never quite sure what to call it, buoyed her. When he looked at her just like that, she knew that she'd do anything he asked. She might have even jumped off that bridge with him as long as he'd held her hand on the way down. Granted, these thoughts of devotion were often fleeting. She questioned him almost as much as she revered him. But right then, in the Jeep hugging the side of this mountain, the unpaved road so riddled with potholes that she was getting carsick, she felt like they could overcome anything together, that the world could be theirs. That's probably why she took off her seatbelt and decided to lean in close and breathe her secret into his ear. She could have simply called out her confession over the wind, but she needed to deliver the news gently. The rest of their lives together depended on it. Chapter 2. Jax. After. I'm FaceTiming with Beth for the second time today when the police show up. I swing the door open, half listening to one of my sister's long-winded, albeit hilarious, stories about some moms at her children's elementary school who want to petition the school board to allow them to manage their kids' school projects. "They come out so much better when we're involved," one of them had said, without a trace of irony in her voice.
"Are you Mrs. Morales, wife of James Morales?"
I nod, dropping the phone to my side, my sister still speaking loudly as her view changes from my mud-brown hair and matching eyes to the dark denim of my jeans. I take in the static sound coming from the walkie-talkie on the female cop's slender hip, the handle of a gun protruding from the holster of her stout partner with a thick mustache, their squad car in the background. She rattles off their names, which I immediately forget, then points to the olive-green front door, the only thing distinguishing our modest tract home from the others on the block.
"May we come inside and speak with you?"
"Why? Is something wrong? Is James okay?" I ask as I study the knotted skin between the female officer's deep-set eyes, my mind clicking the pieces together.
"Mrs. Morales, may we come in, please?" she repeats,
and I wonder in a flash of annoyance as I stare at her partner's thick black hair, if they'd planned this, that she'd talk to me. Deliver the bad news I sensed was coming, woman to woman. She steps closer and I jerk my body back, the heel of my shoe catching on the doormat. I lose my balance and grab onto her arm to steady myself. She offers me a sad smile, but still, I don't invite them inside. I want a few more seconds of not knowing.
"Jax?"
Beth says my nickname, and I silently turn the phone around so she can see the cops.
"Mrs. Morales."
The officer looks down, and I realize I'm still gripping the heavy fabric of her uniform, my knuckles bright white against the blue polyester. She puts her hand over mine, her skin cool and smooth. She guides me through the doorway, her partner easing the front door shut behind us. The three of us silently lowered ourselves onto the red chenille couch. Ironically, it was purchased on one of my shopping binges when I tried to fill what my therapist had defined as the hole created by James' perpetual absences while traveling for work. I have a closet full of shoes, a bathroom filled with cosmetics, and a kitchen stacked with gadgets, all bought in the same mindset. Beth would come over to survey my latest haul, then give me one of her looks. I stare at my sister on the screen of my phone resting in my palm, and together we hear the news that will seem surreal for weeks, like a bad dream I'm fighting to wake up from. May 21st. Maui. A car crash. The road to Hana. Cliffs. Lava rocks. A fire. His wallet with ID found several hundred yards from the car. Yes, they'd need his dental records to be absolutely sure, but they felt confident it had been him. Confident enough to show up on my doorstep and tilt my world on its axis. I tried to process the words into separate thoughts, but they all blur together into one long, rambling sentence. Beth starts to cry the kind of heavy tears I've always envied. My emotions have always been much harder to conjure. I know my sobs will come, but I won't have any idea when, just that my body will finally give. The screen of my phone goes dark, and I know Beth has hung up and will be on my doorstep in just minutes. She lives only a mile and a half away. She will arrive with a tear-stained face, staring at me incredulously when mine isn't like hers. It's hard to explain, but from the moment I hear he's dead, I'm both desperate for and afraid of feeling my husband's loss. I stare at the two officers flanking me on the couch that has never been as comfortable as I wanted it to be. Then eye the laundry basket filled with mismatched bath towels that I'd been folding earlier that morning. I wish it were 5 minutes earlier. Because 5 minutes ago, I was just a fourth-grade teacher taking care of the dirty clothes that had piled up this week while I was cleaning out my classroom and getting ready for summer hiatus. 5 minutes ago, I was laughing with my sister and making plans to meet her for lunch. 5 minutes ago, I wasn't a widow. I wonder what the officers will do when they leave my house. Will they think about me again? Or will I be quickly forgotten as they stop at Starbucks for iced caramel macchiatos on the way back to the station? The male officer speaks for the first time since arriving, his baritone voice sounding out of context.
Is there anything we can do? Anyone we can call? I mean, other than...
He doesn't finish his sentence. Instead, he motions toward my cell phone. My sister. She'll be here any minute, I say.
Okay.
Good, he says, and scoots forward on the couch.
Do you have any questions?
I stare into his eyes. They are kind. Pale blue with errant flecks of brown dancing around the pupils. The truth is that there are so many things to do, and there is an overwhelming number of calls to make. I imagine breaking the news to all the people who loved James. I'll dial their numbers, then lean my head against the cold granite in the kitchen as they cry, in the same desperate, unbelieving way I haven't, but eventually will. Oh, how I will. And of course, there are so many questions, but I only have the strength to ask the cop with the kind eyes the most important one. What the hell was my husband doing in Maui? Chapter 3. Jax. After. It's ridiculous how your life doesn't need your permission to turn upside down. You think you have it under control, that you're good at handling the colossal disappointments, the ticket for the illegal U-turn, the late fee on your credit card that sends your APR through the roof, the dry cleaners fuck up. Okay, maybe you weren't so good at dealing with that last one and would probably take back that terrible Yelp review you wrote. They'd refuse to admit to ripping your favorite black pants that made your legs appear longer and leaner. You'd never find another pair that slimmed you that way again. It was a tragedy. But then your husband dies, and you think how you'd beg for the apocalypse of the torn pants. Because now it's your life that has ripped apart at the seams you thought were so tightly sewn. I've been binge-watching Shark Tank because I can't sleep. And it reminds me of James. He'd always wanted to invent the next great thing. When the smug college freshman turns down Mr. Wonderful's $50,000 offer for his pointless collapsible hangers, I want to tell the kid that life is short, to take the damn deal, that he'll never miss the 5% of equity he's hanging on to like a life raft. James would have said yes, wrapped Mr. Wonderful in a tight bear hug, and thrown the hangers into the air in celebration while all the sharks erupted in laughter. James charmed people in the same way he took a deep breath, easily and without much thought. Every day since James' memorial 2 weeks ago, still a blur of dark suits and tear-stained faces, has started the same. I haul myself out of bed a little after 10:30 a.m., the haze of the sleeping pill I took the night before still lingering. I pour a cup of dark coffee, add 3 lumps of sugar, turn on my laptop, and wait for the numbers on the digital clock to hit 11. 8 in Maui. I picture Officer Kealoha staring at his phone as it rings. I know from my Google Images search that he has a round face, thick brown hair speckled with gray, and a wide, inviting smile. I can imagine his jolly expression shifting when my 949 area code illuminates on his caller ID and he debates sending me to voicemail. To his credit, he never does. The first time I talked to him was the day after I found out James had died, after the female cop had pressed her card into my shaking hand with Officer Kealoha's name and number written on the back. After she and her partner had waited with me until Beth arrived. After Beth had thrown her arms around my shoulders and stroked my hair as if I were a little girl. After she had spent the night and held me in our guest bed as I fell in and out of sleep. The harsh reality of the news I'd been given hitting me all over again each time I woke. Officer Kealoha listened as I told him my story. How I was shocked to find out James had been in Maui, because he was supposed to be in Kansas. I rambled about how we'd been married 8 years, about how he'd never lied to me before, that I knew of. I was aware I sounded like a desperate widow, not wanting to accept that her husband had secrets, but I couldn't stop talking. And it didn't help that he didn't try to fill the lulls. I think he knew I needed someone to understand that this wasn't supposed to be my life. When I asked how he could be sure it had been my husband in the car, he gently walked me through much of what the officers who'd come to my house had already told me. How James's brown leather wallet with his driver's license and credit cards had been found not far from the wreckage. That they'd interviewed Heidi from the rental car company, who'd confirmed James had rented the Jeep, and that the signature on the agreement matched the one on his ID. They'd also verified that James's name was on the manifest of the United Airlines flight from LAX to Maui. That he'd used the same Citibank Visa, which I had no idea existed, that had been in his wallet to pay for 4 nights and several sightseeing excursions at the Westin Resort and Spa in Ka'anapali. His voice became tender when he reminded me about the next part, that because of the fire, the only way to be 100% sure it was James's body that had been in that car was for our dentist to confirm James's dental records. I couldn't bring myself to think about what that meant. So I held on to the sliver of hope that provided, that there was a possibility it had all been a huge misunderstanding, and James was in Kansas, closing the software deal he had told me was so important. But then our dentist, Dr. Matias, delivered bad news all over again. So it was confirmed. My husband was dead. But why had he died in Maui? Every time I think of James tearing out of our house the morning he left, my insides ache. He was wearing a starched white button-down and gray trousers that rose up a bit too much when he sat. His light brown hair was longer than usual, hitting the collar of his shirt. His 5 o'clock shadow already in full force, dotting his deep olive skin. Ironically, I had the thought that he looked more like a surfer going to the beach than a salesman on his way to a conference. He blew past me with a tight grip on his carry-on, muttering obscenities in Spanish, his worn black leather laptop bag slipping off his shoulder as his sturdy body barreled toward the driver parked out front. I could see a man with a short white beard watching us and could only imagine what he'd been thinking, how many of these types of scenes he'd witnessed in his amateur driving career. And the worst part, we'd had this fight before so many times, and I knew we would again. Or at least I thought so. Was that why he'd gone to Hawaii? Because I couldn't give him what he wanted? Because I'd let him believe that I could? That I was not ready to explore. I've walked through my house day after day since I found out he died, looking for an answer I'm realizing I'll never find. Why? I've tried to find out why James wasn't in Kansas like he was supposed to be, but the answer eludes me, the same way his truth seemed to. So right now, I have decided to focus on something I can control, something manageable, mundane. I'm trying to get the kitchen spout to stop leaking. The water is almost therapeutic, causing a rhythmic echo as it hits the inside of the sink, reminding me of those drummers in the New York subway making music by hitting the top of a paint bucket. I turn the handle on the faucet to the right, remembering my father's instruction from when I was a little girl, and he directed me to turn off the hose that was attached to the slip and slide. Lefty loosey, righty tighty. It's funny the things that stick with you and the things that don't. Since James's death, I'm discovering that the mind works in strange ways. I can recall his smell without putting my nose to a single item of his clothing, because I can't bring myself to. I cannot even look at the sleeve of his crumpled, pale blue button-down shirt peering out from the top of the hamper. But the scent is there, as potent as when I buried my head in his shoulder and breathed him in on our first date, the second margarita I'd drunk making me brave. His musky aroma is entangled in our bedsheets. It's emanating off the last bath towel he used. It's clinging to my nose hairs like my grandmother's perfume, which she treated like a can of air freshener. It's a comfort, but also a terrible burden, still smelling him. I've had moments where I've longed for hyposmia, the decreased ability to smell, a definition I only learned because I Googled it at 3 a.m. I'd been hugging James's pillow between my legs like an anchor and smelling him so strongly in the pillowcase that I could almost tell myself he'd just been lying there and had gotten up to go to the bathroom. His scent assails me, while I try to make sense of remembering only some details about James and not others. Like the way his hands felt. I have no idea. Were they smooth? Calloused? Did I ever take the time to notice? I grabbed Beth's wrist when she came over this morning, trying to memorize each of her fingers. They felt soft, and as I touched the small scar on her palm from when she'd sliced through it while chopping tomatoes, I promised myself I wouldn't forget them. I can't manage to remember the sound of his laugh. I've been trying, the way you do when that actor's name is on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't spit it out. Squinting hard as if the concentration will help me recall it. A few nights ago, after polishing off half a bottle of port, the only alcohol left in the house, I tore through a box of home videos, searching for the one from our wedding. I wanted that moment when, after Tom gave his best man speech, James let out a belly laugh that rippled through the courtyard of the hotel. It was infectious, that laugh, and now I can't remember it. And I never did find the video. James and I had 8 years together, but in many ways we hadn't even made it out of the gate, like a racehorse that gets spooked by the sound of the gun. So many things had held us back. The loss of his job during our first year of marriage that led him to the one he had, that forced him to be out of town each week. My arrogance that we could wait years after getting married to start a family. Which leads me back to the whys. Why did it end before it ever really began? Why were the last words we spoke to each other hostile? Why can't I forget how he blew past me out of the house and got into the Uber driver's rusted Toyota Camry without looking over his shoulder? Why can I still feel the way the house trembled after the front door slammed? He shouldn't have died. He paid his taxes. He coached Beth's son's baseball team. He was thoughtful, once turning the car around to drive 20 minutes when he realized he'd forgotten to tip our server. Why had the knock from two police officers been on my door? Why not on the door of the awful woman from across the street who once yelled at a group of gap-toothed kids in our neighborhood for placing their lemonade stand too close to her driveway? Why not hers? After 3 glasses of Sauvignon Blanc at James's memorial, which Beth had planned without my even having to ask, I'd found the courage to ask his boss, Frank, if he knew James had been in Maui. My stomach churned as I studied Frank's bushy eyebrows and his bloodhound eyes, both wanting and not wanting to know if Frank had been covering for him, that I was the only one not in on the joke. It was incredible how many questions I wanted and didn't want the answers to. It felt like when I had learned to drive, the instructor jamming the passenger side brake as I pumped the gas. But Frank shook his head vehemently. He knew only that James had requested a few days off. Nothing more than that. And oh yes, he was so very sorry. Later that night, after Beth and I had said goodbye to James's mom, Isabella, and Dad, Carlos, my parents, and a few other stragglers. Beth searched the house for clues. She actually called them that, like she was starring in a bad episode of Law and Order. We started with his personal items that had been shipped back to me and arrived the day before. I unzipped his suitcase and sifted through his clothes, pulling out a mix of clean and dirty items, my hand resting on his favorite bathing suit. A pair of red board shorts with a frayed waistband. The same ones he'd worn on our honeymoon. I dug deeper, but there wasn't so much as a bar receipt. His cell phone and laptop proved to be just as unhelpful. Every single password attempt denying me access to the man my husband had been. The thing was, I had naively, or stupidly, I don't know which at this point, Never thought I'd need that access.
Chapter 4 Jax, After
Our conversations about where James was going on business always went something like this. Him. I'm off to Des Moines, or another city name, tomorrow. Me. When will you be back? Him. In a few days. I'll text you when I land. Me. Okay, can you pull the trash cans out before you go?
We were finishing our fettuccine Alfredo when he mentioned the Kansas trip. I looked up from my plate and watched the noodles swirling inside his mouth as he told me he'd be leaving the next morning and would be gone until Saturday. There was a dinner he couldn't get out of on Friday night. He went on about how the clients were impossible and closing this deal could potentially double his bonus check next quarter. I frowned, mentally canceling the reservations I just made at a new Italian spot down the street, trying to convince myself that maybe the timing was good. I had a ton of prep work to do for the end-of-school-year open house in the fourth-grade class I teach. That night was just a week away, and I still had to decide how to display the kids' essays about their heroes and come up with a creative idea of how to showcase their family tree projects. Noticing my face fall, James came around to my side of the table and kissed me softly, and my irritation began to dissolve, as it often did. We fell in and out of arguments easily, like that snap on your shirt that doesn't quite clasp. You think you finally secured it, and then bam, 10 minutes later, it's popped open again. Could I have asked him more about his trip to Kansas? Sure, but I wouldn't have. I had stopped doing that a long time ago. In the beginning of our marriage, I'd pepper him with questions about his job, but he would give me clipped answers, finally admitting he saw his job selling web conferencing software simply as a means to an end, a paycheck. One day, he'd leave and start his own business. He had ideas, ones that didn't involve the lack of legroom in seat 17C, or the gate agent who loved to scold you if your carry-on was larger than 22 by 16 by 10 inches. He liked his job and was very good at what he did, but he hated all the travel that went along with it. So I learned not to ask about it, and definitely not to bring up his plans to leave. I never thought he was lying about jaunting off to Sioux Falls or Wichita. I believed he would have much rather been home with me every night. Our marriage was far from perfect, but did I think he was cheating on me? Never. Not even in hindsight. Maybe that made me naive or stupid or a little bit of both, but I was happy I wasn't one of those wives with trust issues. I heard it all from friends whose husbands traveled, that they required their spouses to check in several times a day, to supply them with a full itinerary, to regale them with details about their trips when they returned back home. I didn't want to be like that, requiring it, as if he were my employee. I liked receiving the texts he sent on his own, which came frequently. Quips about the sea of Nebraska Cornhusker shirts he saw in Omaha, or the endless number of BMWs he spotted in Dallas. He'd text selfies while stuck on the tarmac. I could reach him whenever I needed to. So did I get his travel plans like those controlling wives I know? I didn't. Clearly I should have. Those women obviously understand how the world works much better than I do. Their husbands may resent the hell out of them, but they are home safe, while mine has just been delivered to a columbarium at the Good Shepherd Cemetery. So maybe if I'd been more checked into my husband's life, I wouldn't have been so shocked by what Officer Kealoha told me when I called him the day after the memorial. It turns out that James hadn't been alone when he died. He'd been driving down the Hana Highway in a rented Jeep Wrangler with a 24-year-old woman named Dylan Matthews. And my first thought, I'd once asked him to rent a cherry red one when we'd taken a road up to Monterey, and he'd scoffed at the price. I think my mind went there because it couldn't handle the reality of what I was hearing, that he'd been in Hawaii with someone who wasn't me. According to the officer, Dylan's body had washed up on shore 2 weeks after the crash. At first they didn't put it together that she could have been with James in the accident,
But after investigating, they'd found her name on the same flight manifest as his, and at the Westin Ka'anapali, where they'd stayed. She'd shared the same room number as him and had charged a manicure and pedicure to it. Her signature was also on many of the slips from drinks and food they'd ordered at the hotel. And then there had been the surfers who'd watched James pull Dylan in and kiss her hard on the morning of the accident. Actually, the way they'd described it was getting up on each other on the side of the Jeep. That detail stings. A lot. But not as much as imagining this woman getting her nails done on my husband's dime. Somehow that feels more intimate. But that wasn't all. There were other sightings. The day they'd driven the road to Hana, they'd stopped at the Kuau store, just past the town of Paia, on the Hana Highway. According to the cashier who had worked that shift, James and Dylan had just taken pictures at the famous surfboard fence and were laughing about how Dylan was posing for a selfie and fell back into the boards. And James' credit card charges confirmed he'd been there. He purchased goat cheese, salami, a bottle of wine, coconut water, banana bread, and a Road to Hana CD guide. As I listened to the officer rattle off the information, I couldn't decide which detail about their trip bothered me the most. The Jeep James wouldn't rent for me. The romantic picnic lunch I imagined them enjoying as they sat by a waterfall. Or the CD. James and I had always laughed at the people who got all touristy and bought things like that. Had I known my husband at all? But there was information I still wanted that Officer Ki Aloha couldn't uncover from credit card statements or the memories of store clerks. Why had they been in Maui together? How long had they been seeing each other? Did he love her? Did he love her more than me? Officer Ki Aloha tried to be empathetic, but still said hugely unhelpful things like, "I'm sorry, and if there's anything I can do," as I choked on my sobs, the tears finally falling hard. Like the waterfalls I imagined James had hiked to with the woman who ruined my life. Chapter 5. Jax. After. Here are the things I now know about the road to Hana after obsessively Googling it. It's 52 miles of highway. It passes over 59 bridges. There are more than 600 curves. It carves into the cliffs of one of the most beautiful rainforests in the world. Because of its many winding roads, blind turns, distracting views, one-lane roads, and tall cliffs, it is considered dangerous. As one of the websites described, it can bring you to God in more ways than one. No shit. Apparently, there are multiple fatalities there every year from people falling off the 300 to 1,000-foot cliffs, some in cars, some on foot, and hitting the lava rocks below. My husband and Dylan Matthews are now on that list. Here's what my Google search didn't provide. Any helpful information about Dylan Matthews. I learned that she graduated from a high school in a small town outside of Phoenix. She had no Facebook profile I could locate, no Twitter account. She wasn't on Instagram. A very poor millennial, if you ask Beth. I'm pulled out of my thoughts by the doorbell. I squeeze my eyes and mentally will whoever is outside to leave. I can't face another well-meaning neighbor with a casserole. I've started to polish the already gleaming stovetop when the knocking begins. The longer I ignore it, the more incessant it becomes. Finally, I peer through the peephole and see the back of a man's head, his wavy hair not giving anything away as to who he might be. He turns and cocks his arm to knock again, and I take in his dark eyes and square jaw, not recognizing him. Is he one of James' friends? I received several emails, phone calls, and cards in the mail from old buddies of his who couldn't make the service. Maybe this guy is one of them, in which case I can't leave him standing there. I open the door slightly, leaving the chain on. "Hi," he starts. "Are you Jacqueline Morales?" I hesitate, then nod. "Yes, Jax to most." I notice a motorcycle parked next to the curb. "I'm Nick Ford," I look at him as if to say, "And?"
He steps closer.
"You don't know me, but I need to talk to you."
He pauses as a woman walks by with her golden retriever. "It's about your husband."
I glance down at the welcome mat, his worn cowboy boots grazing the edge.
"Okay," I say, as I look back up into his dark gray eyes, which feel familiar to me somehow.
"Can I come in?"
I feel uncomfortable letting a stranger into my house, but there's something about his demeanor that's disarming. I remove the chain and step outside, closing the door behind me. "I'd rather talk out here." I smile slightly to let him know I'm not trying to be rude.
"I don't know how to say this. I had it all planned out, but now looking at you, it just seems wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have come."
I stare down at my boyfriend's jeans rolled at the ankles, my bare feet, the chipped pale pink polish on my toes. I smooth my still unbrushed hair, wondering what he means. Now that he's looking at me, it seems wrong.
"How did you know James?"
"I didn't."
He shoves his hands into the pockets of his jeans and takes a deep breath.
"But my fiancé, Dylan Matthews, did. And I'm here to find out why she was in Maui with your husband."
Chapter 6. Jax. After. My breathing is short and raspy. My legs are burning. How do people do this? Run for sport. I see cars driving by, people walking their dogs, tiny faces pressed up against the windows inside a passing school bus. But I don't hear any sounds. It's like someone pushed the mute button on the world around me. My calves are on fire, and my face is dripping with sweat, and I have that damn ache in my side. But I push myself harder anyway. When did I grab my Nikes and lace them up? Leave the house? It's all such a blur since I told that Nick person to get the hell off my property. I can picture the sleek black iPod that James gave me 5, or was it 6, Christmases ago. He grinned like a goofy schoolboy with a crush when I opened it, launching into a spiel about how he knew I thought exercise was boring, how I'd never found a physical activity that I enjoyed, that maybe I should try running, an amazing endorphin releaser. But I would need music. That was the key. He'd even created a playlist for me, Jack's workout mix, and he suggested an afternoon run. I eyed the bottle of wine we'd planned to open after presents, but decided I'd do this for him. But a few blocks into our jog, I was already losing pace with James. I tried to let Beyoncé's song about girls ruling the world propel me forward, but my breathing was all wrong, and I got a cramp. I finally had to stop and walk, and I told James to keep going. He refused, walking beside me as I huffed and puffed and even spit at one point, anything to get the offensive saliva out of my mouth. He placed his arm around my sweaty shoulders, my shirt soaked through with perspiration, and we continued in silence until I finally begged him to not let me hold him back. He stopped when I said that. Right there in the middle of a busy four-way intersection. The red hand was blinking, but James wouldn't budge, cocking his head and frowning at me. "What?" I asked, as an SUV inched into the crosswalk, ready to make a right turn, but we were blocking its path.
"You'd never hold me back, Jax. We're in this together. We're a team. Haven't you figured that out by now?"
"I do know that," I said sheepishly, watching the red hand count down the seconds behind him. The light turned green, and the driver of the SUV held his hand on his horn, the long blare jolting me. James grabbed my hand, tugged me onto the sidewalk, and kissed me on the forehead.
"I'll speedwalk race you home," he grinned.
I shook my head, suddenly determined to push myself out of my comfort zone. I slowly took my gait from a fast walk to a jog, James running behind me in disbelief.
"You sure?" he said. "Don't feel like you have to run for me."
"I don't. We're a team, remember?"
And back then we were. I didn't realize then the change that was coming. If I had, maybe I would have cherished that moment, that version of James Moore. But I didn't. I took for granted that he'd always stop and wait for me. I was wrong. I think that iPod ended up buried under half-sharpened pencils and incomplete decks of cards in the junk drawer later that month. But maybe it could have helped drown out my thoughts today as I sprint to Beth's house, because no matter how large my stride or how hard I pump my arms, I can't outrun them. Dylan Matthews' fiancé, Nick, showed up on my doorstep like a Jehovah's Witness trying to convert me. And I let him preach. I allowed him to speculate about my husband's relationship with his fiancé, to ramble on about the things he needed to know to move on with his life. I listened to him as he paced in front of my house, shaking his head and saying that he just couldn't believe it. How could they do this to him? To us? I had all the same questions, but there was a part of me that was scared to find out the answers. It was so much easier living in denial, telling myself James had just been having a midlife crisis, that this woman, Dylan, meant nothing to him. I thought of the time I'd snuck downstairs when I was 8 years old and peeled the scotch tape carefully off my birthday gift to reveal the Teddy Ruxpin I'd begged for. Afterward, my chest had felt heavy with guilt. My greed had outweighed common sense. Listening to Nick's words reminded me of that night. My hunger for information causing me to ignore the obvious. Finding out was going to hurt like hell. But that's the problem with letting your curiosity overrule your conscience. You can't change your mind afterward. Nick told me he'd found emails they'd sent each other. Did I want to see them? He said he needed to know if they had been serious, if they had loved each other, if they were going to leave us. That last one, it hadn't crossed my mind. Then it was all I could think about. I turn onto Church Street and come to an abrupt stop in front of Beth's tan two-story home. I press my hands against my throbbing quads, trying to steady my breathing, hating that my ability to drive seems to be another casualty since James went over the cliff, because getting behind the wheel would have been such an easier way to get here. The front door opens. My God, look at you! Beth rushes down the steps and bends over me, her mud-brown hair that matches mine hanging around her creamy complexion dotted with light freckles. I know. I hold out my hand so she can pull me up. Could use some water, please. She gives me a once-over, her perfectly tweezed eyebrows arching over her light brown eyes. You ran here? I nod. Because I couldn't... I don't finish. But we both know what the rest of the sentence would be. Get in a car. I did attempt to drive, just a couple of days after I found out. I was going to buy wine, many bottles of it, preparing to drink myself into a dreamless sleep, anything to stop the nightmares. I slid into the seat of my Mini Cooper and started it just like I would have any other day. But as the engine roared to life, I saw a flash of James' face, grimacing as he tried to steer the Jeep away from the cliff. My heart pounding out of my chest, I started gasping for air, my hands tingling so much I almost couldn't get the driver's door open. Then I laid my cheek against the cold, oil-stained garage floor and sobbed into the concrete until I managed to move myself into an upright position and call Beth, who came racing over again. When she found me, resting against a bag of fertilizer, I looked at her and shook my head. As I follow her inside now, I watch her nylon shorts start to slide down her slim hips, and she tugs them upward. I'm amazed that after birthing 3 children, she's been able to maintain her high school figure. She'd cheered, literally chanting a "Go, fight, win!" after she'd found her red, white, and black cheer uniform in a bin and zipped it up as if she were still 16. But then again, she works at it. Without asking, I know she's already dropped her kids at summer camp, been to a 9 a.m. Soul Cycle class, and blended a paleo-approved shake. As a lover of processed foods, anything with that orange stuff they're trying to ban, I find eating like a caveman feels as unachievable as making the Olympic track team. Shoes, Beth calls over her shoulder. I mean, if you don't mind, she adds quickly, turning her head and giving me a quick, toothless smile. It's funny how people hold their tongues when you go through something awful. I caught my neighbor, who spent years knotting her gray eyebrows together when my garbage cans were still sitting by the curb long after trash day, dragging them up our driveway last night, pulling forcefully as one wheel got stuck in a deep crack that appeared after the last earthquake. And Beth. She's been on her best behavior since James died, replacing her typical blunt opinions with kind and gentle responses that seem foreign coming from her. What she doesn't understand is that I wish she would go back to her normal personality, because I need her to be her. I need her unfiltered commentary about my life, her know-it-all attitude, her need to be right. It's not just Beth who's been on first date behavior. Before James died, my mom, who lives in Solana Beach, a sleepy beach town about an hour south of my neighborhood, would rarely make the trek all the way up to Aliso Viejo because northbound traffic is just the worst on the weekends. And now she has miraculously gotten over her commuter issues and has been religiously making the journey once a week to check on me. She's never been a big believer in comfortable silences, so as she scrubs my spotless countertops and heats up some casserole we both know I'll never eat, and fluffs pillows and opens windows, she relentlessly throws words my way, telling me stories about her book club or my dad's refusals to stop eating red meat, tiptoeing around me like I'm a landmine she might trigger. What my mom doesn't get is that I don't need her to come to my house and rearrange my coffee table books. Just because James is gone, she doesn't need to change. She doesn't need to prove anything to me. It never bothered me that she didn't drive up to see us. James and I liked going down to visit her and my dad, the coastal setting making us feel like we were going on a staycation the minute we arrived. But Mom's unwillingness to come up north to see Beth and me, and our father's silent alignment with her, drove Beth insane. Can't she do it for her 3 grandchildren? Doesn't she realize we have soccer and gymnastics and we are busy? I swear it's Poochie Poo. She can't leave that dog for 5 minutes. I'd tell her that was crazy talk, that of course it wasn't about the dog. But she'd spit back that I was too agreeable, that I accepted things too easily. And she's right. I usually do. Part of me wonders if that's why I'm standing here now, with questions outnumbering answers. I force my sneakers off without untying them. Beth hands me a glass of water and sets my shoes neatly by the front door next to 3 pairs of soccer cleats in varying sizes, waiting for me to tell her why I'm here. She knows better than to ask if I'm okay, or how I'm doing, or if I slept last night. I've banned all questions like that. I take a long drink and look at her, my eyes watering. It's just a lot. Come here. Beth wraps her arms around me, and I stand there stiffly like a child being cuddled by a great aunt she barely knows. I'm afraid if I hug her back, I'll dissolve into tears, that I won't be able to stop. I pull out of her embrace. I had a visitor. Beth frowns, waiting for me to continue. A man. Apparently he's Dylan's fiancé. Or was.
Wait, what?
I tell her about Nick. How he felt so familiar to me even though I was sure I'd never met him. How he'd held out Dylan's driver's license, which the police had mailed back to him to prove his connection to her. How I found myself staring into James' mistress's bright blue eyes, her white blonde hair resting on top of her shoulders in a simple, blunt cut, her bangs swept to the side. I had read over her descriptions as Nick watched me. 5'2", 103 pounds, contact lenses, organ donor, lived in Irvine. Birth date, July 7th, 1992. I felt my stomach twisting into hard knots as my brain computed the differences between us. 9 years younger, 22 pounds lighter, 4 inches shorter, blonder. We sit and I explain to Beth what Nick said when he came to see me, that he hadn't been able to sleep since he found out his fiancée died because he needed answers. He needed to understand more about Dylan, about James, about the bond they had formed together, seemingly right under our noses. He wanted to travel to Hawaii to retrace their steps. It might sound crazy, but would I go with him?
He asked you to do what?
Beth interrupts me. To go to Maui with him. A perfect stranger. Yes. But what I don't say is that we are connected by this event in a way that no longer makes us people who don't know each other. He said I'm the only person who can understand what he's going through. That the simple police report deeming the crash an accident won't tell him the things he really needs to know. Why his fiancée was cheating on him with another man, and why she was in Maui with him. He thinks going there could help fill in the blanks. Honey, Beth puts her hand on my knee. I don't mean this to sound harsh, because I love you, and I'm so sorry you're going through this. But what good can come from taking their vacation? It's worth noting once more that pre-accident Beth would have never prefaced anything with, I don't mean this to sound harsh. She would have just said it, along with an eye roll and an impatient tone. So I know she'll bite her tongue rather than chastise me if I confess the rest. That he suggested retracing their exact steps. Had they eaten coconut shrimp, sipped piña coladas as the sun set? Did they kick their shoes off and stroll down the beach? But still, I don't tell Beth this, because I know she won't understand why there's a part of me that shares Nick's morbid curiosity. And that I would strongly consider running my hand across the bed they slept in, leaning over the railing of their lanai and taking in the same view. Looking in the mirror over their bathroom sink to try to make sense of what he saw in her. Maybe that's exactly it. Going to Maui could help me understand why he was willing to risk the comfortable life we'd built. Because I can't ever ask him. Beth's concern is obvious, and I get it, because I'm thinking it too. Whatever answers I find might make it all worse. Don't worry. I kicked him off my front steps, I say, as I watch her face soften. She thinks this means I'm not going, but the problem is, I can't stop picturing his hunched shoulders as he walked to his bike. How he'd slowly slung his leg over the seat, then pulled his helmet on. How the sound of his motorcycle firing to life had startled me. How I'd watched him until he disappeared down the street. But, Beth asks, sensing my thoughts. Only 11 months apart, we've always shared a bond, an intuition as strong as if we'd shared a uterus. But, I pause, remembering his eyes filling with tears when I told him to go away. Not recognizing the sound of my own voice. How do I explain to her that I both want and don't want to know more? I'm curious about the shrimp and the sunset strolls, but frightened to find out about the real emotions they might have shared. But what if he's right? What if going could help? I know it may sound crazy to you, but there's a part of me that understands exactly why he needs to go to Maui. I pull my long hair out of its ponytail, the elastic ripping several strands. Okay. Beth pauses, and I watch her try to compose herself. She wants to be the old Beth so badly, to tell me what an idiot I'm being. Instead, she clears her throat and says,
So a part of you wonders, but what about the other parts? Do you really think that I should just accept that he was having an affair and leave it at that?
You're not answering my question.
And you're not answering mine. I fold my arms across my chest.
Fine, she says. Yes, I really think that. I just worry that going will create even more questions, and then you'll always be wondering what the answers are.
I hear you, but Nick did make a good point. He said he didn't want to be in denial anymore. That he wants to face it. All of it. And the only way to do that is to be in Maui.
Wouldn't that be torture? Why would he do that to himself? To you?
So we can try to move on. I realize that I've said we rather than he. I reach into the pocket of the sweatshirt I'm wearing, an old one from James' fraternity days. He told me to hold on to this. I hand Dylan's driver's license to her. He said he lived one floor up from her in the same condominium complex, that I could find him there, if I changed my mind. She studies the ID for a moment, frowning slightly, then flipping it over so we're both staring at the magnetic stripe on the back.
Okay, so maybe I can understand why he wants to go, but why does he need to take you? And how can you trust him? What if he's not who he says he is?
Who else would he be?
He might have read James' obituary and be some kind of stalker weirdo looking to prey on you because you're grieving.
You've been watching too much CSI.
Please, you know I'm a true detective girl.
Whatever. My point is, you think I'm overreacting. I gave her a look.
Don't you realize it's my job to protect you?
Especially now?
Her bottom lip quivers, and I put my hand on top of hers.
Well, if it helps you feel better about him, he's a fireman.
He showed me a business card with the station he works at, and he showed me several pictures on his phone, including one of the two of them at a fireman's ball from only a few months ago. I think of the crushed silk fabric of Dylan's floor-length cobalt dress, her hair swept back from her face, her hand placed across the front of his starched uniform, the sparkling ring on her finger.
Jax, I'm sorry. None of that proves she was his fiancé. He could have photoshopped her in.
He didn't strike me as a techie. More like a beefcake whose only hacking is done in a jiu-jitsu class, I joke.
When Beth doesn't respond, I add, listen, I hear you. But he seemed sincere. I think of his hand shaking as he gave me her driver's license. I had resisted my impulse to console him, but what was there to say? How could I convince him there would be a time when his insides didn't feel like they'd been hollowed like a jack-o'-lantern when I didn't believe it myself? I'd wondered how he could stand to look at a photo of her. Of them. I had asked Beth to remove all pictures of James from our house for now. It was like a knife slicing into my abdomen every time I looked into his deep-set eyes, always my favorite part of him. Instead of remembering the good times we'd had, all I could see were the years we wouldn't have, the dreams we wouldn't build, the family we wouldn't create.
You never answered me about the other parts of you, the parts that don't want the details.
There's a part of me that wants to ball up on the couch, the part that wants to pretend this never happened.
Beth points to her couch. Go right ahead. I'll get the wine.
I shake my head.
Beth, if I lie down, I'm afraid I'll never get up, that I won't recover from this. If I go to Maui and face whatever it is they were doing there and why they were doing it, as awful as it may be, then maybe I'll be able to move forward, to have a normal life again someday.
Okay, but do you really think you can trust this guy?
Yes. I saw his hurt. It was real.
and that was what it came down to for me. When I searched Nick's eyes, I saw the grief that mirrored my own. Beth looks up at me and takes a deep breath before speaking.